Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is a perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender, and there's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. We'll fight to the death. We are soldiers. We are soldiers.
Conversation and also the libertarian conversation. And thank you for coming to the show. It's also part of the Patriot Journalist Network, where you can find that by going to the Facebook, if you are a Facebook user, going up into the search engine and just put Patriot Journalist Network on there, and you will find it. And also, I like to give a shout out to my other friends on the Conservative Conversation, which is Samuel Samford, and you can find his show weekly every day from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. or sometimes 2 a.m. Eastern Time, and then on Friday and Saturday evenings you may find the Rex and Tex show from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And another way you can find a link to the Patriot Journalist Network is by visiting the Bard's Logic Political Talk website, in which you could find a link to there from the Blog Talk Radio show's homepage for Bard's Logic Political Talk. And if you are new to the show and you like what you hear tonight or previous nights, feel free, and I would actually ask that you can follow the show. It's real easy. Just there's a little follow button underneath the icon, and just click that, and you'll be well on your way to following the show. And I thank you ahead of time for doing so. Now, tonight, there will be further discussion on state sovereignty with more historical details. And we'll also be tying in current events, such as Egypt, and a shocking recent reactive actions of the federal government. We'll also be talking about solutions if states were respected per the intent of the Founding Fathers. Also, after 10 p.m. this evening, we will be piping in live the Ben Swan's reality check, and he is talking tonight about the more violent protests against the U.S. breakout in the Middle East countries. Plus, if U.S. policy will change moving forward. And that'll be sometime after 10 p.m., and I'll be keeping an eye on that. So tonight we'll have a panel calling in, and the Bard's Logic panel, which is Kelly Mordecai, Chris, and hopefully Rex Christie, will all be calling into the show this evening. And at this time, I will let some members of the panel in, and if you could just call in, introduce yourself to the audience, and then we can start in on our discussion of states' authority and sovereignty. So I'm opening up the mics. I've got 360, 530, and 954. All three of your mics are open. So if we start with Chris and Kelly, and I believe that may be Rex. Go ahead, guys.
Hey, everybody. This is Chris. I'm looking forward to this. I've just had some incredible conversations around this whole topic. And if anything, we are learning how little we know, you know, and how much we thought we knew that was wrong even. So I'm really fired up about this. You know, we have a lot of conversations behind the scenes, and Kelly's doing great work, and he's really giving it all he's got. And I'm really looking forward to him leading the charge on this. And I know Rex is going to have some great input. You know, he's got that historical, you know, political perspective. So I'd like to get one more person to call in that I think is just about a constitutional scholar. Had about a 2-3 hour conversation with him today, and I was just stunned by the amount of information that came out of his mind. And hopefully he comes, you know, calls in. We'll see. But really, this is, you know, this is Kelly's baby, so he's the man.
And Kelly, you out there?
I sure am. How you doing, Robert?
Great, great. Good to hear from you again. Go ahead. You have the floor.
I'm really excited about this. Just like Chris said, I'm still learning. And, I want to follow up a little bit about last Monday's Gary Johnson thing, where he kind of endorsed equality in marriage and abortion at the national level. That has not quite been the historic libertarian position. I want to make some points here of what Harry Brown wrote. He was the Libertarian Party presidential candidate in 96 and 2000. And he wrote this book that says Liberty, A to Z, 872 Libertarian Soundbites You Can Use Right Now. And the point of it is that Harry Brown understood states' rights. It's not about abortion, it's about states' rights. So just kind of read a few of these points, and then I want to get into the Egypt situation, current events. This is, point number one. Given the government's record with the war on poverty and the war on drugs, we can assume that a war on abortion would lead within 5 years to men having abortions. And the way he says this is quite humorous. But number two, government doesn't work. It doesn't protect adults on the street. It doesn't protect children in the schools. Why should we think it's capable of protecting unborn children? Two more points here. actually three. There's nothing in the Constitution authorizing the federal government to deal with abortion in any way. The federal government shouldn't subsidize it, encourage it, discourage it, or prohibit it. And it shouldn't try to overrule what the people in any given state decide to do about it. And here again we go, state sovereignty. And then here's one last point. I am anti-abortion and anti-government. If I were president, my abortion feelings would be irrelevant because the federal government should have nothing to do with the subject. But my anti-government feelings would be all important. I mean, I wouldn't make the mistake of allowing the federal government to enter this area or any other area not authorized by the Constitution and mess it up even more. So Harry Brown got it right as far as understanding several issues we've talked about, that these are the hands, these issues are in the hands of the states, not in the federal government. Now, Gary Brown, or Gary Johnson, seems to be a little bit more of a Democratic libertarian. So it's just kind of a little thing that I dug into and decided to share that is a little bit of a follow-up. So, yeah, I'm just excited to talk more about states' rights. And people can follow along getting on the hiddenfourthbranch.com, page 9E, State Sovereignty. I've got a nice chart that's going to go through the history of how we went from a king / dictator into a representative form of government. And so I'm just kind of saying that ahead of time. But
I'll post that, Robert, Kelly. I'll post that. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I will post that as soon as I get logged on onto the blog site.
Well,
you want that, right?
Well, actually, Chris, if they go to the home page of this episode's show and they go into the description, there's already a link provided for the website. So that's, I mean, if you want to do that and put it in the chat as well, that'd be great. I just want to let you know.
Okay.
That's been provided.
I'm having troubles logging in right now. Blog's logic. I mean, it does this where you go to the next dialog box, pump, you know, comes up, and you're trying to skip, and it just sits there and flashes. So I'm going to reboot anyway. So I'll be back in a minute. Go ahead.
Okay.
Sorry, Kelly. I didn't mean to stop you.
Well, that's good. I believe we have Rex on the line as well. Rex, you there?
I'm here, Robert.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for calling in. While we're waiting for Chris, if you'd like to chime in, and then we'll get back to Kelly, and then we'll see if Chris is back by then. So go ahead, and we'll go from there. And thank you real quick, Rex,
sure.
Thanks for the update on that, Kelly. I think that really adds to to Monday night's discussion. So go ahead, Chris. I mean, yeah, Chris. Rex.
In following up to what Kelly just said regarding Mr. Brown, I will tell you that and I think I've mentioned this to you before, Robert, but in 92, I was so disappointed, having grown up as a Reagan conservative and voting for George H.W. Eat My Shorts, No New Taxes Bush, and being sorely disappointed, thinking, wow, you know, I thought he was going to be like Reagan, but he's completely not. I strongly considered voting for Ross Perot, but I was young and stupid and easily badgered into, no, that'll cost George Bush the election. You have to vote for George Bush. So I voted for that loser twice, I'm ashamed to say. But I wasn't going to make that same mistake in 96. And so I didn't vote for him. And I think Mr. Brown was the better choice, and I think the world would have been considerably a better place if that had happened. But I digress about my history. The reason, I think, is because a lot of us are very disappointed in having fallen for this, lesser of two evils, vote for the main parties, and third party is a throwaway vote, which is absolutely a lie, and it is a mental cage that we're stuck in. And then the other thing, of course, is there's always the fear of, oh, my goodness, what happens if the federal government, you know, gets another Marxist for 4 years and everybody freaks out? And I think that the thing to remember is that federal government is one government that we have. There are 50 others. There are 50 governors, 50 legislatures, and 50 Supreme Courts. So there is nothing to fear with a diminished or even a non-existent federal government.
That was well
good
said.
Man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Greg, go ahead, Kelly, and then Chris. Go ahead.
All right, yeah, this is a short one. Back in 92, If my memory serves me right here, but you guys remember Ross Perot? Someone call him Ross Perot. You hear that giant sucking sound? That's the sound of the federal. That's the sound of the federal debt. That guy. Well, he got 19 million votes as a third party, and then Bush Senior got, I think it was 38 or 39, and then Clinton got 44 million. So, 19 million, the third party. That's like that was a big surprise.
I have an article. I'm going to post it for everybody. That's a Gallup poll, and they finally, this late in the game, run a whole bunch of stats on opinions of third parties and in trends going back for several different election cycles. It's a very good article. I'll post it in a second. But the thing that caught my eye was very important to understand that you see that the trend for approval or positive trend, you know, of the American public towards the third party ranges anywhere from 48% to 58%, depending on the year. So half this country is thinking about it, is positive about it. But another part of the trend you'll see when you look at the article, it's real short, you can see the trend graphs, but I thought it was very important, is right as they roll into an election season, the trend goes down. And you know why? Because you look at people start getting scared. It's them against us, us against them. If you don't vote for us, then you get them, and they're on their side scaring the hell out of everybody about the Republicans. We're on this side scaring the hell out of everybody about Obama. So people, they lose that enthusiasm for the potential of a third party at election time. It's an interesting little trend, but it shows at least half the people in this country are positive about it. So the question is why does it die after elections are over, and what is it going to take to empower and keep that conversation going and educate people on the things that we're learning about these people? Because I'm excited to learn. I like to learn, you know, and I'm a dummy. I didn't even know what a third party is because I, you know, fell into the same mind numbing programming that everybody else has been, and that is third parties don't work in America. Repeat after me. It's in your cereal, it's in your sound waves. You know what I'm saying? You know, I mean, it's just insane because they do work. The GOP is proof of it. And that's what blew me away. The GOP was the rebel, libertarian, or constitutional party in 1854 that said enough of the corruption of the Whigs, enough of the elite not listening to us, enough of the grassroots being stepped on. So they went out and formed a new party called the Republican Party. I'm done.
Yeah, well said. One of my themes that I keep repeating is that the federal government has become way too powerful, and I want to go ahead and illustrate this with the recent news regarding Egypt and now how the federal government has responded against an American citizen, and it's a little spooky. But, as you know, the Muslim Brotherhood, they basically took over our embassy, and that was in retaliation from a film, The Innocence of Muslims. And the director slash playwright, his name was Sam Basili. And there was obviously hatred towards him now, of course, and he's in hiding, both from our government and the radical Islams. But there is a recent, just today I saw this in Breitbart.com, the State Department denied the Marines from carrying ammo. In other words, they were not allowed to lock and load when this situation happened. That was in Breitbart. Yeah. And it's also, there's intel that we have with anti-Muslim Brotherhood, okay? And this was on WorldNet Daily, that this one paragraph I'm going to read you. It was reported yesterday that just last month, U.S. intelligence agencies monitored a meeting between officials of the Egyptian and Iranian intelligence ministries, raising the specter that the newly installed Muslim Brotherhood government in Cairo could be secretly backing terrorism worldwide. Members of the anti-Muslim Brotherhood, they're the good guys over there in Egypt, as opposed to the, you know, Muslim Brotherhood. All right. Members of the anti-Muslim Brotherhood opposition believe Barack Obama has signed off on a covert agreement to support the Morsi government. So a little spooky when the Marines are saying, nope, you cannot lock and load. And then there's something missing also from these stories. Sometimes we can learn a lot from what is missing. You know, for example, Christ rose from the dead. What's missing? He wasn't bitter. That's quite a statement right there, going through all that they went through. He wasn't bitter when he came back from the dead. But in the situation, there was no Marines killed. They weren't shot. Now, if I was a Muslim Brotherhood, you would obviously want to take out the first person that would oppose you. The Marines weren't shot. Now, here's the question of what is missing here. Did the Muslim Brotherhood people know that the Marines were not armed? If they knew the Marines were not armed with bullets, how did they know? And is this why the Marines weren't shot? It's only questions of suspicion, but, you know, it's a little, what's going on here, folks? Well, our government has responded rather interestingly regarding the producer, Sam Basile. They recently revealed his real name, Nakula, something like that. He's in Southern Cal. And there's an AP thing, if I can dig it up quick. This is from AP. Federal authorities identified a Southern California man who was on a federal probation for financial crimes as a key figure behind an anti-Muslim film that has spawned mob violence against American embassies across the Mideast, a U.S. law enforcement official told the Associated Press today. There is no sign of Nakula Basile, 55, at his family's home. Details emerged. Oh, he's among the Southern California's right-wing Christian organization, and he's central in the production of this film. Well, of course, the media always paints anybody that might be a Christian as bad, 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 you know, right-wing extremist, yada, yada. His he was a very key assistant in this, Klein, Steve Klein. He told Bill something. He said, look, you do this film, and you're going to be... you can be the next Theo Van Gogh, who was killed in 2004. Theo Van Gogh produced a similar movie about the Muslims in Europe, and, well, he ended up dead. So right now, Mr. Basile, or Mr. Nakula, is hiding because he's under investigation by the Department of Justice, i.e. Eric Holder. Yeah, why are we investigating a movie director? Freedom of speech, isn't it? So our own government is investigating a Hollywood type. How did our government get to this?
I think it started in 1776, which I know you're going to tell that story. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean...
I'm just being facetious, but it really... It really is the story of why we're doing this show or whatever we're doing, you know, the series, you know, is where did it start and at what key points as we continue on through our history did it get out of control, and at what point did we absolutely become traitors to our own constitution, our own country? I mean, I don't know, is that too strong of a word? It seems like it, doesn't it?
Well, one little trick of... becoming a terrorist to our own country is by definition. Definitions, yes, words. Of course, all words have meanings. I just saw the other day, it's U.S. Department of Homeland Security. It's called the U/FOU Domestic Extremism Lexicon. It's basically a handbook for, well, who should we investigate? Who is a terrorist? Well, here's the definitions of terrorists. And it just so happens that Mr. Steve Klein... he's a Christian, he's a former Marine, and, you know, in helping Mr. Basile, Somebody pegged on him that he was a he was training paramilitary militias at a California church. And since they're tied in to Basile, you know, we know each other by loose definition, it looks like under this nice little handbook that they can classify him as a terrorist. I'm going a little more deeply into what our federal government has become so we can talk about states and how we can actually push back. But I'm going to read a little bit from this domestic extremism lexicon because there's a definition that Mr. Klein falls under. We'll get to it. All right, here's kind of an introduction. Homeland Security Reference Aids, prepared by the DHS Office of Intelligence and Analysis. It provides the baseline information on a variety of Homeland Security issues. This product is one in a series. Oh, yeah, a bunch of them, huh? One in a series of reference aids designed to provide operational and intelligence advice and assistance to other elements of DHS, as well as state, local, and regional fusion centers. DSI and DHS intends this background information to assist federal, state, local, and tribal homeland security and law enforcement officers in conducting analytical activities, i.e. spying on people, Patriot Act, NDAA. This product provides definitions for terms and phrases that often appear in DHS analysis that address the nature and scope of the threat that domestic, non-Islamic extremists poses to the United States. Let's go through some definitions here.
Wait. That was, let me ask you this, Kelly. You said that was a DSHS document?
Yes.
Okay. Did you hear what you just read? Because this is something, you remember that video that, you know, people got a little freaked out about Richard Gilbert's video when he got off in the internment camps and the fusion centers. Remember he said there were 72 spy centers inside our country for the purpose of monitoring citizens in this country, and everybody said he was crazy? Well, you just read that word right off that document.
Yeah. Provide operational intelligence advice and assistance to other elements of DHS, as well as state, local, and regional fusions centers.
You mean that they're in on this conspiracy theory also? In other words, it's a fact. Oh my God. Yeah, you think all my conspiracy buddies are nuts. This year, I'm beginning to think I was naive.
Well, at this point, I've got Rex. Would you like to chime in on any of that? And then I did bring a caller in 954. And if we're open to a few calls, I've got another person also on hold. Rex, did you have anything you'd like to chime in about on any of that?
Well, as a card carrying, tinfoil hat wearing conspiracy theorist.
I hear all those helicopters flying over your house too, right?
Yeah, well, I can't see them. They're black, but, you know, the guys in them are wearing blue helmets. Look, if the tale they keep telling you about how these things happen and how they occur and how they result keeps proving to not be true, then you're going to have to entertain another theory at some point. And I think that most of us have reached that point, and those of us who haven't are going to reach it pretty soon. Look, the fact is that a false flag operation does not have to be an orchestrated conspiracy. I mean, think about it this way. The so-called Arab Spring has just been waiting to happen for 14 centuries. It's only by the power of despotic dictators that it's ever been quelled. And we did a great job last year of helping topple all of those dictators so that we have released that craziness. It doesn't take much to instigate. It's a matter of having a convenient, quote, enemy to set things up, because the fact is that fear drives people to be more acquiescent and seek security over liberty. So I'm not saying that necessarily this is something that was done intentionally, but it was certainly set up in a way where it could very easily come to happen, and then it becomes something very simple to take advantage of. And, you know, at this stage of the game, you got to see how things interconnect, and whether you view it simply as you know, the hand of God, whether his active will or his passive will, or you view it as, you know, some kind of Mr. Moriarty somewhere in the world trying to move the chess pieces. Either way you look at it, it is definitely not random coincidence. So I think that we have to be very wary how we react to these things because, like I said, fear is used to control your mind, and having this discussion about state's authority should belay a lot of people's fears if they understand it, because the biggest fear is that if something goes wrong with our federal government, we're going to be living in anarchy. Well, that's just simply not true. And so you got really nothing to be afraid of other than your own fear.
Right. Great point. Great point.
Yeah, well, 50 state governments, yes. Well, I'm going to read some of these definitions.
Go ahead,
hold on, Robert.
I mean, I'm sorry, Kelly. Go ahead, Kelly. Well, after I read the definitions, we did have a person on 954 has been waiting for a while to chime in briefly because, I mean, you know, we've got the panel here to go over all the information. But if people would like to chime in just you know, briefly some comments or questions for either, you know, Kelly or Chris or Rex or even myself, of course.
As long as we don't get into the Illuminati and all that stuff, we'll be okay.
Well, and that could be for another day. I mean, that's actually something that, you know, might be interesting to talk about.
We could lose our direction if we go there.
Well, no, not tonight. That won't be tonight. No, I'm just saying maybe a different show, a different night. I had an uncle who was really into that. But anyway, go ahead,
I know,
Kelly.
I know Rex is into it. He's got that tinfoil hat.
Yeah, May 1st, 1776 is when the whole thing started.
Yeah.
Right,
go ahead, Kelly. Go ahead,
Kelly. Kelly, you're in trouble.
I got to throw in a little joke, okay?
You got Rex and Robert on, so you're in trouble.
You remember Jeff Foxworthy, he'd say, well, if you got a belt buckle with your name on it, you might be a redneck. Well,
no, I'm just kidding.
if you're a part of a group, like a New World Order, if you're part of a group that denies its own existence, you might be a Bilderberger. Alright, alternative media. This is one definition. A term used to describe various information sources that provide a forum for interpretations of events and issues that differ radically from those presented in mass media productions and outlets. Now, gee, Robert, if this definition was expanded and perverted because of your alternative media, you might fit that definition. All right, let's go to another one. Extreme group, an ideologically driven organization that advocates or attempts to bring about political, religious, economic, or social change. Wait a minute, isn't that what we're trying to do? Or social change through the use of force, violence, or ideologically motivated criminal activity. Well, of course, we're not criminals, but they can make us into a criminal with whatever law we break every day. All right, militia movement, This fits the two guys I was telling you about. A right-wing extremist movement composed of groups or individuals who adhere to an anti-government ideology, often incorporating various conspiracy theories. Members oppose most federal and state laws, regulations, and authority, particular firearms laws and regulations, and often conduct paramilitary training designed to resist perceived government interference in their activities or to overthrow the U.S. government through the use of violence. Also, see also, citizens' militia, unorganized militia. Okay, here's one, patriot movement. A term used by right-wing extremists to link their beliefs to those commonly associated with the American Revolution. The Patriot Movement primarily comprises violent anti-government groups such as militias and sovereign citizens. See also Christian patriots, patriot groups, constitutionalists. All right, here's another one, okay? And we're in trouble right now. Those of us listening, you're going to probably fall under this definition because we're going to talk about state and local authority. This is called right-wing extremism, a movement of right-wing groups or individuals who can be broadly divided into those who are primarily state-oriented and those who are mainly anti-government and reject federal authority in favor of state or local authority.
Are you kidding me?
It's right in there.
Well, we got to shut our show down, guys.
Well, good night, everyone. Take care. I'm just joking.
Oh, my God. Are you kidding me?
Wow.
Would anybody like a tinfoil hat?
My wife's in there right now making me one.
Hey, honey.
You're flipping kidding me. You mean
to
tell me. You mean to tell me that the original foundation of this country and the history and the forming of it is now a no-no to talk about? Wow.
Well, we could be defined as such to be investigated.
I got to tell you the truth. I'm fairly sure that we're already being monitored. So continue about your business.
Hi, guys and gals.
You know, maybe they'll learn something about states' rights, and then when it comes time to pull the trigger, they're going to not do it. So, I don't know. If we can peacefully track them to our message, that would be good. By the way, speaking of...
Yeah, I don't know. With rest on the show, we might not be able to.
Are you trying to single me out and draw attention away from yourself? Look, I'm perfectly confident that the levers of civilized power at our disposal and that none of this crazy stuff is going to happen. The only way it's going to happen is if you give in to the fear and make it happen. Because the fact is that the illusion and the prison that they're building for you with all these statements and calling you terrorists and writing the extremists and on NDAA and all that stuff, it's an invisible prison of your mind. You are the only one who can put yourself in it. And if we all panic, it will happen. If we keep our heads about us and use the power that our founding fathers handed on to us through generations who sacrificed and bled for it, then it won't happen. We'll win. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be a long battle. And, you know, it's not for the faint-hearted.
Rex, I don't live in fear. That's the only part of the conspiracy theory people that I can't handle is that they have the same, that's that fear message. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
That's one of the reasons why I stopped listening to Glenn Beck. He just became too negative for my liking. He just got too negative. But anyway, at this time, guys, let me bring in 954. I know they've been on hold the longest. And then we have two other callers, 1434 and then 254. You guys have some brief comments or questions to anyone on the panel, and then we can get back to the information that they want to share tonight. So go ahead, 954, your name,
okay.
And just out of my own curiosity,
Robert.
Where you're from.
Robert, hi, this is Harriet, and I'm I'm just going to remain quiet.
Oh, okay.
Okay, now, Robert, Harriet,
yeah.
You can spank anybody on this show that gets out of line. You get them.
Yeah, well, that's why I'm keeping quiet. That's why I'm keeping quiet. I don't want to start a fight.
She is the show monitor, so folks, we've got our own show monitor here. So
you don't want me.
At least tonight we do.
Yeah. Well,
so are we
right
now that you scared the hell out of us, Kelly? Are you going to take us farther down that road, or are we going backwards now? I'm not being facetious. I'm just curious.
Well, I think we got the point that I wrote something real long. I can probably post it somewhere else, but. Basically, if a federal agent who wants to make a name for himself, if they want to expand, expound, pervert these definitions, they can basically, move up the chain of command at our expense, and we would be placed in a position of proving our innocence by having to hire attorneys. And this is where this country has gone to at the federal level. And it's just point blank a little bit spooky. I don't know how you guys feel about it. Oh, by the way, this last definition... It says nothing about a group that's advocating violence or actually does violence. It just says if you're starting to learn about state or local authority, oh, say the Posse Comitatus Act, 1878, where the sheriff is the supreme law enforcement of the county, i.e. Sheriff Mack, Prince versus U.S., all that. It's just totally in the face of the way our country was set up. But this is where the federal government, is it going to get better? Are they just going to wake up one day and say, oh, we're sorry, we're going to now study the Constitution? Or is it going to get worse?
Well, I think that's kind of, it's kind of up to us. When I mean us, I mean, I think it's up to we, the people, the masses of the United States, the ones who are supposed to be the ones to wield the power when it comes to the government. But at this time, I'm going to have open up the mic for 434 and just state your name. And as I said, just out of my curiosity, I just curious where people are from. And then if you have a statement or a question for anyone here, please ask it. But I do have two rules, and I'll tell the people I see here. One, no profanity. I mean, if there's, ass or something like that, that's fine. But or damn, whatever, that's not bad too. But if there's just no Fs or GDs or anything of that nature, or Ps, on the show. So anyway, and of course, be polite and respectful to everyone, either in chat or here on the call. So 434, I'm opening up your mic. Your name and where you at, and what's your comment or question?
Yeah, my name is Dale. I know Chris, and probably a lot of y'all, but at this point, I feel that we have 56 days, and that before the election, and
okay,
we all need to unite, and that behind someone. Now, I've already chosen my candidate, and I think everybody knows who that is, because he has a good track record, and although everybody doesn't love him, I haven't seen anything that he has said other than one thing, and basically it's been contradicted in essence, and I can explain that to Chris and that later, but after you've been on the show a while, you'll figure it out. But it doesn't matter. I mean, I feel that, we need to unite to beat what we're facing right now. And the people have a voice. That was taken away from us at the RNC, definitely, because I wasn't formally even following this candidate. But I didn't even know about him. I'd never heard of him. But I was following someone else at that point. But after I saw what happened at the RNC, and every candidate that ever was a forerunner in the Republican convention was basically suspended their campaign for some reason or another, whether it be, as we all found out at the RNC, either violence, threat, maybe even broken bone. I mean, who knows? I wasn't there, but I heard a lot of stuff. So, and I talked to a lot of people that, and people get scared over that. Well, I walked all the way through all that, and I know what happens. So that doesn't bother me anymore. And I've tried to confide that in some people without explaining it too much. But I know how the family works, boys. And I'm playing your game now in a different way. So, and I'm playing both sides against the middle. And I'd already picked out who I feel the best for, and I think it'd help our country the best. At this point.
Who's that?
Because
right, but we're not. But we're not discussing candidates.
I don't want
to get on you because you're my friend. But I'm just saying that's a whole other conversation.
I understand that. That's why I'm not mentioning names or anything else.
You know what? You know, tomorrow night we're discussing one of the candidates, and we're working on getting the other candidates people on the show. So.
Well, I wish that all the damn candidates would have been on the show to start with. And I'm not talking about from now. I'm talking a year ago.
Not just on the show, but
that they would have all had equal shot when it came to the RNC. But you had too much manipulation. First of all, with the Bain buyout with Obama, which financed Romney and that, and paid for his maybe paid for his horse to go to England, whatever. But you know the rest. But it didn't matter. And he was a Democrat until this year. Didn't that strike a bell with anybody? I'm just kind of befuddled by all this, and I know a lot of people are, and that as well. And I think the majority of people I've talked to have all thought the same thing as me, is that basically we need a reconstruction of our government system.
That might not be the best word to use for those of us who live below the Mason-Dixon line.
Well, I didn't say that. I'm just saying that, you know, maybe some things need to be fixed. I mean, our country didn't get broke overnight. It ain't going to get fixed overnight either.
Right.
Yeah, this is where I want to segue into the states, because I have a lot to cover yet, but at least you've displayed how scary the federal government is.
Well, do you want people to pull up your site now so they're on top of that, or are you ready for that?
I can pull it now, but I'm going to read a quote from Alexander Hamilton.
The link I put a new link in there because the link that Robert has takes you to another page on your site, and you get lost trying to find the other one. Go ahead.
Oh, so
sorry.
You can get to Robert Lee. Yeah, State Sovereignty 9 is it.
Excuse me, do you hear the helicopter above my head? Good thing I have my little
tinfoil hat
on.
Yeah, your tinfoil hat. Excellent.
Well, okay, Dale. Thank you very much for calling to the show, and enjoy the rest of it. And we hope you call in again another time.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Take care. Have a good night.
Bye.
Continue listening. Thank you. Okay. Go ahead. Go ahead, Kelly. Finish your thought,
okay.
And then if anyone else like to the chime in of the panel, and then I have 254. But also remember, folks, it's about 9:45. And a little bit after 10 o'clock, we will be piping in live from my location, the Ben Swan Reality Check, about the more violent protests against the United States breaking out in more Middle East countries. And also, I guess you can discuss the question, will U.S. policy change and moving forward? So go ahead, Chris.
Well, we need to give Kelly a lot of airtime because he's got a lot to cover. So.
Oh yeah, definitely, you know, definitely.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I mean,
okay,
that's why we're having a series of these, and that's why I think, you know, and probably having a series of these shows because there's just so much to get out there.
Cool.
Well, yeah.
Go ahead,
all
Kelly.
Right, this is a quote from Alexander Hamilton. Because they were discussing the Federalists, Anti-Federalists, whether we should have a big central government or not.
Well, Alexander Hamilton,
yeah, he nailed it. He goes, what?
Sorry. You got to slow down, man. You're an engineer. You went hyperspeed on us.
Oh, sorry. All right. Well, in the colonial days, they were thinking central power or not, Federalists, Anti-Federalists, et cetera. Alexander Hamilton nailed it. He said, with regard to the jurisdiction of the two governments, I shall certainly admit that the Constitution ought to be so formed as not to prevent the states from providing for their own existence, and I maintain that it is so formed and that their power of providing for themselves is sufficiently established. That the two supreme powers cannot act together is false. They are inconsistently only when they are aimed at each other or at one indivisible object. The laws of the United States are supreme as to all their proper constitutional objects. The laws of the state are supreme in the same way. And one of the things that one of the ways the federal government has brought the states to its knees is through, like the IRS. When you put the words together, the and IRS, it spells theirs. The people, from their back pocket, write a check to what they believe is the federal government. The federal government takes that money and says, okay, states, if you want this money, you will do A, B, C, D, and all the way through Z. And then there's gas tax. That's another one. Goes federal government. The government says, okay, we're going to give some of it back, but you must do Q through Z. It's a bad position to be in. And because the Federal Reserve prints money out of thin air, the states suffer inflation. They can't afford it. They have to turn over to Big Daddy for the money. And so in this statement, I admit the Constitution ought to be so formed as not to prevent the states from providing for their own existence. And so that's where Hamilton was going. Well, actually, you know, the colonies were actually, we're talking, you know, 1620 Massachusetts, 1610 Virginia, all the way up to the 1700s when the king started getting bad. They were providing for themselves, and they sent a little back to King George. But in the understanding, I'm going to go to that chart here pretty quick, and understanding the culture, if you will, the culture of the colonies turned states from the 1760s, then the 1770s, the 80s, the 90s, all right, imagine our culture, how we've changed from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. It's, some would say it's not so good, but we have, in those of us who have been around that long, we have seen these cultural change. Well, so did the colonials. They had to go from a king dictator who became a tyrant. They had to come to, how are we going to make a new government? And so in the year that the states became the states, this is that magic chart on the website, on July 4, 1776, a day in history, each of the 13 colonies became their own states. These United Colonies are and ought to be free and independent states. They have full power to wage war, conclude peace, contract alliances, and to do all other acts and things which free and independent states may have right to do. And last time I was on, I was asking people to do their homework and understand states when they read the Declaration of Independence. So going on from there, the states had their own state constitutions. That's the next column. Eight of them finished having their state constitutions in 1776, and in 77, two more joined, and later three other states had their own state constitutions. But they were their own. In 1776, they opened their sign for business. Okay, we're the government now. We're not going to listen to King George. Boom, done. Of course, they had to fight until 1783 to win their independence. So in the, and even again, I've said this before, but four states had a state constitution. Actually, there were colonies at the time. Starting in New Hampshire, January 76, in March, South Carolina did their colonial-approved state constitution. Virginia, the end of June of 1776, the colony of Virginia said, this is our state constitution if we go for it. And then New Jersey, on July 2nd, 1776. Now, could you imagine if you're living in the colonial era and all of a sudden New York Times says, New Hampshire has developed their own state constitution. It's like, what? They're still a colony. And then, you know, a few months later, South Carolina did the same thing. Then Virginia. I mean, this is a breaking news story, folks. It's like, where is this country heading? And so, sure enough, they did it. They fought. They won. Then they realized they needed to have a little bit more formal of a union. Their union was, from the Declaration, was our lives, our fortunes, our sacred honor. That's what held the bonds together. So in 1778, the states, yes, I said states, not colonies. In 1778, the states ratified the Articles of Confederation. And in 79, Delaware was a little slow, and then Maryland was a little bit slow. They did it in 1781. Now, once they had a Articles of Confederation, they formally joined the Union. 1778, there was 11 states that did that, 79, another one, and in 1781, we had a union of 13 states that were once colonies. They were the States United. Of course, we call them the United States. In fact, the formal term, United States of America, was absent for 2 years. Since July 9th, 1778, is when the Articles of Confederation were adopted, and Article Number 1 said, this formal union will be called the United States. That was the official name. So what happened those from 76 to 78? The states were fighting on their own and a loose union. So, you know, 2 years the federal government didn't have an official name. It's just kind of like, oh, that's kind of mind-blowing. All right, so then we go to the joint union. All right, so then the Constitution, okay? The Articles of Confederation weren't working very well, so they started working on a Constitution. They started in May of 87, September 17th, coming up. Constitution Day is when they got it done. Then they sent it off to the states. And in the Constitution, there is a ratifying clause required. It's Article 7. The ratification of the conventions of 9 states shall be sufficient for the establishment of this Constitution between the states, so ratifying the same. So 9 states had to give the federal government approval. If there was never, ever any... No states approved the Constitution, we wouldn't even have what we have now. That's how powerful the states were. And again, my whole point is the states created the federal government, not the other way around. So they got it out in the states. Three of them did it in 1788. This is 12 years after the Declaration. They got the 9th state. And New Hampshire was the 9th state to ratify the federal constitution. However, New Hampshire was the first colony to approve its own state constitution. So on June 1st, 1788, Ninth State ratified, boom, we had an effective constitution. Oh, and by the way you read the Article 7, it's only effective on the nine states. Only when the other three consented did it finally become effective in all 13 states. Then, well, they started having elections in 1799. Of course, George Washington won as a president. And then in I think one of the first orders of business for the first Congress was, hey, you know what, we're getting a lot of requests from the colonies to confirm and acknowledge our rights. And upon the petitions of the colonies and states, they authored the Bill of Rights. And then they sent it out to the states to get ratified. And as you can see from the chart, different states came in at different times. Let's see, Maryland and Jersey and North Carolina were the first three, and that's 1789. The 1790, we saw five more come, and then we saw Virginia as well. So then, you know, over the course of New Hampshire did too, a little error there on the 1939. But three states, interesting, Connecticut, Georgia, and Massachusetts didn't ratify the Bill of Rights until 1939. It's kind of a strange historical anomaly. But, however, the amendments were still in effect in all these states.
Okay,
that's kind of the progression, if you will, of the colonies becoming states, throwing off the king and becoming their own states, and then creating a federal government with limited power.
Okay, real quick, we're coming up on 10 o'clock, and we have a person on here who's been waiting for a little while, actually a while, to call in. And so just come in if you state your name, and then, you know, it's just for my curiosity, what state, and then if you have a brief question or comment, go ahead. And then, Kelly, if we bring this over to bring it over to Rex after the caller and after they ask the question and make your comment, and then we'll go from there until we get that reality check. So 254, thank you very, very much for holding, and state your name and where you're from and what you got for us tonight.
Hi,
hello, 254.
You got me? You hear me?
I hear you.
Okay, hi guys. This is Ken down at Fort Hood, Texas.
Texas, great, thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on the Middle East topic, if I could.
Sure.
Okay, I wanted to present the idea of force multiplier into that equation that was being discussed earlier, in the sense that in order to fight a war or to grow a opposition or support for a war, what is required is something called force multiplier, wherein one side or the other is able to grow their base, basically. And I'd like to touch on the idea that perhaps the conflicts in the Middle East are something that can't really end unless we just stop playing the game, based on the fact that the Islamic world over there, the extremism, is fueled by the United States, our presence over there, their hatred for us. That is their force multiplier, if you're familiar with military terms.
Well, I would contend that that's not the only reason why they hate us. I'm sure that is a part of it, but I'm sure that's not, all of it. And would Rex, Tex, or Chris, would any of you like to chime in on that?
Well, I'd just point out the fact that these United States were independent of Great Britain in 1776. So explain to me how the Muslims hated us for 1,100 years before we started meddling around in the Middle East.
Well, the way I'd counter that is our force multiplier at the time when we went sovereign was Great Britain trying to assert its authority over us, who wanted to be sovereign.
Right. But the assertion that prior to our involvement in the Middle East, the Muslims were peace, happy, fun-loving people is just you know, ridiculous. No, they've been violent. They've been violent since the 6th century. So I don't buy that. I mean, granted, I'm not going to dispute the fact that our interference doesn't have blowback and doesn't cause problems, but that is absolutely not the reason that the Muslims are the way that they are. The fundamental problem is Islam. It is an imperialistic, plundering ideology that is
right.
A political movement wrapped up as a religion. So it isn't our fault. I mean, we might be instigating it, but the fact is that even if you left them alone, they'd come after you. The first foreign military conflict that these United States were involved in was when Thomas Jefferson sent our Marines to Libya to fight the Muslims. So I'm not buying that it's our interference over there that's causing them to rile up.
No, what I'm saying is that our interference over there is their force multiplier, which is not that is their ability to recruit. It's their mechanism for recruiting.
Oh.
Whereas religion is like the idea, the backing behind it, the mechanism, the way they convince people to blow themselves up is through force multiplying.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay, I get where he's coming. So
well, yeah, I mean, obviously
we could talk about this. I'm
go
sorry,
ahead.
Rex.
No, Chris, go
we
ahead.
Could talk. We could talk about this for an hour straight. You should call in the Sandwich Show tonight, and we could go back to that.
Yeah. So, for instance, a great example of say force multiplier is when the United States sends Green Berets into a country and says, "Hey, you guys don't really like your government. You want to overthrow your government? We're going to supply you weapons and intelligence and train you how to do this and train you how to train others to do what we're teaching you to do." That's another example of a force multiplier. It is providing a group of people to basically multiply, i.e. terrorists, in this case. So you would think that if this was like conventional war, you would just you'd go up against the enemy and kill them, and that would be that. But the problem with this particular conflict over there is that every one of those terrorists we kill, they become a martyr. And what happens in that is normally, you know, their family or friends convert to a more radical way of thinking. Hey, the Americans killed our friend or family member, and now we're going to blow them up. So now by killing one, we created three or four more. That is a force multiplier. That is why the way we are conducting our affairs in the Middle East is not rational, because we are providing for means to grow.
Well, I want to go into comments about that.
I could argue that we're just not killing them fast enough.
Well, no, here's the biggest problem with any wars with Islam or radical Islam. By the way, I listened to a missionary that some of the Muslims are very peaceful, loving people. Anyway, but you got the terrorist faction and the dedicated die for all types. But the reality is we don't have an exit strategy. When we go into a country, we expect them to accept democracy,
right,
just like the Germans and the Marshall Plan. But the problem with that is they have been having kings and factions and fighting factions for centuries. Their brains will not accept democracy. It will take decades to bring the youth up into a constitutional type of government to the point that they are willing to die for a constitutional government. And that will literally take decades. And we failed on our exit strategy. And any type of wars that we try to do are going to fail unless they can readily, quickly vote and accept it and be willing to die for it so that civil order is maintained. And that is about an impossibility.
Well, I don't think it's an issue of decades. I think it's an issue of fundamental philosophical baseline. I mean, the only place that there is anything remotely close to democracy in the Middle East outside of Israel, which is only in existence since 1948, is Lebanon, and that's because it has a 40% Christian population. The very simple
right.
fact is that you have tribal segregation that are put into modern nation states drawn up by the Allies post-World War One that are dysfunctional states at best, because these tribes won't get along without a strong man in place. You know, it took us 1,000 years to get to the kind of liberty that we're used to now. You can't expect it to happen in the Middle East in 10 years. The issue is not an exit strategy. The issue is that we were never designed to go occupy. We go in there, we kick ass, and we leave. End of story. And the
Amen,
biggest mistake
brother.
That we made, the biggest yep. mistake we made in Iraq was we won the war in 3 weeks, and then instead of keeping their military in force and setting up a parliamentary monarchy, we decided to give them our kind of democracy. Well, the fundamental problem with any kind of popular rule is that it will always tend to the will of the people. Those people are fighting amongst each other, and they're going to try to use the levers of democracy to beat each other down. So it won't work. The exit strategy now has to be to leave some kind of a severe force in place to quell all that as we leave, because if we just exit post-haste, you're going to create a vacuum, and it's a very, very dangerous vacuum to create.
Well, and the other thing that people don't understand, and this is the thing, is that you have different, and you said this, but, you know, everything from tribal to the Sunni to the Shiites, you have all these different fractions, but they will come together for a common enemy. We're the common enemy. They do not want our democracy. That's the thing that people in America need to understand. We may think we are the best thing since sliced bread, but when they look at our world and our cultural breakdown, and they look at our televisions and our programs and our crooked government, you know, and all the problems in America and our unsafe cities, they go, sorry, we don't want that. Leave us alone. And that's where we have to rethink our policy about trying to turn the world into America. There's a reason American exists. And it's not is a formula of many different things, from cultural to religion to the country, you know, the geographical region. There's just so many factors. It's unique, just like the Earth is unique, you know, in the solar system. And we keep trying to run around the world and turn people into us. A lot of people don't want to be us.
Do we want to be us?
Right now,
I mean, the way we're going, I don't want to be
today. Yeah, I mean, all you got to do is turn on the TV. My wife is disgusted when she turns on the TV. I'm disgusted when I turn on the TV. I listen to the standard conversation in my country, and so yeah, you know, we're going through a cultural breakdown while we're trying to tell the rest of the world that they need to be like us. We need to back up and fix our country if we're going to lead the world.
Well, Chris, you got some really good points, and this caller has some really good points too. And I, you know, I kind of went on, well, if we train them for democracy, when they're willing to die for it, then there'll be some order we can leave. Well, first, what has to be replaced is an idea. The idea is Islam, and there's one thing harder to kill than a virus. Do you know what it is?
An idea.
Yeah. So I'm totally in agreement. But other thing, well,
you know what the difference. Kelly, and the difference between their culture and ours is they actually teach their children their religion and their culture. We teach our children to ignore our religion and our culture. Figure that one out. Who's going to win that war?
Chris, that's precisely why Islam is such a force to be reckoned with right now. Historically, since Muhammad founded the religion, Islam has been a tool. And if you're a faithful person, it's a tool used by God. If you're not a faithful person, then it's just a simple filling in of a vacuum. But it's a tool used to chastise the West for losing its way. Every time that we have been assailed by Muslims, it's when we have lost our way. And prior to World War One, the most recent event was actually on September 11th, I believe it was 1683, when the Muslims had actually invaded Austria up to the gates of Vienna, and it was only because the two feuding kings, the King of Austria and the King of Poland, Jan Sobieski, that they were actually able to defeat them. So this is not a new problem. What's that?
What about the Black Pirates?
I think, well, yeah, that too. I mean, look, the simple fact is that it's a matter of when we lose our way and we become weak and vulnerable from the inside, that's when we get assaulted from the outside. So, you know, the fact that they're teaching their religion, because it's actually a political ideology as well, gives them that temporal strength. But the fact is that if we teach our children the truth, then democracy is preserved, because you can only be free when you know who you are. And right now,
you know,
as a culture, we don't know who we are.
I'm sorry, Rick.
That's, go ahead, Brett.
I have a really important lesson that takes us back to the conversation of state sovereignty and authority, because and I listened to a DVD from book Wall Builders, and they had compiled facts, not a story, but facts. When George Washington became president, they wanted to be a king, but he accepted president, we were paying huge bounties to the Muslim nations in the Middle East, because if we didn't, they attacked our ships and took us slaves and took our goods. And unlike the rest of the world, like England and Portugal and Spain and all the other, you know, colonial power structures that ruled the seas that came out of that era, they had navies and guns that went with their trade vessels around the world. Well, we were a trade nation. That's what made the colonies very wealthy. We had great ships. We had great naval, you know, a great export business, et cetera, et cetera. Now, here's the problem. We had no navy. We had no guns. We fought our war, and we disbanded our army. So in the Middle East, at one time, in the Middle East, when Jefferson came in, they had 1 million European slaves that were taken from ships and conquering in that era. Now, follow history. Go back to this point. Washington could not deal with it. He was trying to build a country after a war. The next guy comes in, and he gets allocation to build a navy, but he would not go to war, even though all this crap was going on. Instead, they paid bribes. And the reason he wouldn't go to war, quote, unquote, he said, "I do not think the American people are ready for another long, drawn-out war." Jefferson comes in, and we all know about Jefferson. He was pretty feisty. He comes in, finds out we are literally – now, check this out, guys. What's our annual budget? Do we even know what it is in this country? What do they spend? A couple trillion?
Over $3 trillion.
Okay, $3 trillion. Now, imagine this figure. I'm going to give you a figure. This is facts, okay? When Jefferson came in to power, he found out they were paying the federal budget. 25% of the federal budget was paid to Muslim countries in bribes to get them to not attack our ships. He found that out. He looked at the new formed Navy, and he said, screw that, and he sent them off to war. He says, we're not paying bribes to people to protect our goods, and he went to war. And that's why the Marine Corps song says, to the shores of Tripoli. Historical lesson. Learn history, folks.
Amen.
Wow. There you go. Right back to state sovereignty in one story.
We should have elected a historian. Does anybody know one?
Yeah, I knew one. Yeah.
All right. I wanted to throw out something about the war, and this is going into states' rights. I got a buddy. He's in the National Guard, California National Guard. He gets called up on occasion, comes back 3 months, his wife says, until he can calm down. But the states are in a position where the National Guard can get called up, and the governor approves it or not. And it is a vulnerable position where the federal government might say, hey, look, we need another 30,000 from your state, like California. And, well, if you don't do it, we're not going to give you some money. That's a vulnerability position, going back to Alexander Hamilton, where he says the states should be able to provide for themselves. And so this vulnerability is not good. Now we've got the DHS that has, you know, working with state and local enforcement. You know, look, the federal government can say to the states, look, we're not going to give you money unless you comply with our DHS orders. This is wrong. Here's a solution. And, oh, that's right, the founding fathers had it. It's called apportionment. Apportionment that says, okay, according to the census, Pennsylvania, you know, you've got about, I'm picking a number here, 15% of the population or budget, you're going to pay for 15%. You just write us one check. We don't care how you get the money. Pennsylvania writes the check. No goodies come back from the federal government to control Pennsylvania. And so when you understand that the apportionment was a better way to go, then what can happen is if a state just says, look, I don't want the DHS. We got enough money on our own. We're not going to pay you this year. And we don't care because we don't get the kickbacks anyway. That is a way of holding the federal government accountable. There's so many other, if you think about the many issues that the federal government dictates over funding, if we were self-sufficient and we had apportionment, the federal government would not have control over us, and it would not grow. And that's how it was set up.
Amen.
Yep.
Hey, I do have a question for you, Robert. Kelly. Jeez, I'm losing my mind.
Yeah,
Robert, go ahead.
Real quick. I just wanted to let the folks know that we will be piping in the live reality check soon, and that's why we continue the discussion about the Muslim issue, because that's what they're going to be talking about on the reality check by Ben Swan, and it definitely is, as you guys were pointing out, tying into the discussion tonight. So go ahead, and then if I interrupt the person talking, I apologize. It's just to let you know that the reality check is on, and I'll be piping it in. So go ahead.
Yeah, I want to finish a quick one. So let's suppose we had apportionment now, and California says, you know what? We've got an apportionment. We found out that part of your federal government, or your federal budget for war was what California's check is, it's going to be 15%. You know what? We're tired of this war. We're not giving you that 15%, and we're not sending any more National Guard people, because we just don't support this war, because it's a bad exit strategy. Under state sovereignty, the way it was set up, the state could actually do that.
Yep. Well, I mean, the idea of a National Guard is preposterous. It's supposed to be state militias. Those are the armies of the governor.
Right.
They're not supposed to be federalized.
Magna Carta
back in the day.
Mm-hmm. Let me add this to you. Remember, Kelly, we were talking today, and I had my conversation with our Virgil Good guy that's going to be on tomorrow night, and he is huge into this early history, and I don't want to embarrass him on the line, because I didn't ask him if I could talk about him on this show. So, but the thing that he said that was was fascinating to me, because I always kind of thought Jefferson was kind of the states' rights guy, and he actually corrected me, and he's actually written books on this, and I'll get all that data as we go on, but he said that Patrick Henry was really the state sovereignty guy.
Mm-hmm.
Jefferson was kind of in the middle. He said Patrick Henry said, quote unquote, in an ad lib, that when they signed the Constitution, he said this will be the failing of our country, because you are going to give away your power to one source. He was against it.
Yeah, well, I saw Virginia in general was, and I tend to think that that's a somewhat extreme view. I think that the Constitution actually was a fairly good balance. Some argue that the Articles of Confederation were better, but especially in the modern world, you do need some of that centralized power in certain situations. The issue is not so much the failing of the Constitution. It's the failing of our hearts. It's the failing of our hearts. I mean, the fact is that the Constitution is merely a written document. It is only the Constitution that we have in our hearts that actually keeps it valid. And the fact is that when we become a fat, lazy, morally bankrupt entitlement society, then we've abdicated our power. It isn't that the Constitution has failed. It is that we fail to use it. And the fact is that the reason that the doomsday zombie apocalypse scenario doesn't have to happen is because the Constitution is still the supreme law of the land, if only you were aware of it. And that's the fundamental problem. I mean, the simple fact is that if people were truly aware of what the Constitution means and what the Declaration of Independence means and what it means to actually be an American, a sovereign citizen, then Mitt Romney would not be the Republican nominee, Barack Obama would not be the president, and right now we'd probably be having a contest between Gary Johnson and Virgil Good.
and with that said, gentlemen, I hate to interrupt, but it is time for the Ben Swan reality check. So I will put down the mic, and let's listen in to see what he's got to say.
I got my one-on-one interview with President Obama about why the U.S. would be fighting al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and just supporting them in Syria. We may now be seeing the price of that foreign policy, one that began under President Bush and has been carried through the Arab Spring. Tonight, the latest on the fallout in the Middle East and why the media's narrative on that Arab Spring can't change the facts. This is a reality check you won't see.
You guys hear that right?
Yeah.
Barely quiet.
Barely.
Good? Barely?
Higher.
The attacks on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, were just the beginning. The first in what is now spreading across the Middle East. No, not the Arab Spring that the national media and politicians want to tell you is the birth of new democracy. Much of what is being sold to the American people by media and politicians is simply not accurate. the idea that the United States has been growing allies across the Middle East since the war in Iraq isn't true. Look at what has happened just today. Violence is once again spreading at the American Embassy in Cairo. Police officers today trying to control protesters, throwing tear gas into the crowd. Protesters now storming the U.S. Embassy compound in Yemen. The demonstrators there are tearing down building signs and burning the American flag, but not entering buildings housing the officers. In Yemen, where the U.S. has conducted more than 40 airstrikes on towns just this year. In Iraq, protesters gathering in an angry but peaceful protest demanding the expulsion of U.S. diplomats. And get this, more clashes following that deadly attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, where four Americans were killed on Tuesday, including the U.S. ambassador to Libya, Chris Stevens. And it is in Libya, this bastion of so-called new democracy, where the U.S. has now sent two American warships to the coast. Today, President Obama already dispatching an elite group of Marines into Tripoli and ordering increased security at all U.S. missions around the world. And in the midst of all of this, the political finger point. President Obama trying to appear in control. Republican challenger Mitt Romney saying that the president has failed to lead. But what you need to know is that the problem, the real problem here, isn't the person in the White House per se. It's the policy. Remember, in my one-on-one with the president, I asked him this question.
You mentioned about al-Qaeda during your speech, going after al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, certainly going after the regime as well. And yet there's some concern about the U.S. funding the Syrian opposition when there are a lot of reports that al-Qaeda is heading up that opposition. How do you justify this?
Well, I share that concern. And so what we've done is to say we will provide non-lethal assistance to Syrian opposition leadership that are committed to political transition, committed to an observance of human rights. We're not going to just dive in and get involved with the civil war. And that involves some elements of people who are genuinely affected, but also involves some folks who would have a long-term view of the United States harm.
And the president's answer is even more important tonight than when that question was first asked. Because the real issue isn't how strong will the U.S. respond to the uprisings in Libya, in Egypt, and in Yemen. The real question, will the U.S. keep pushing forward in Syria when the exact same movement for democracy in Egypt and Libya clearly isn't working? And that is reality.
Awesome. Okay, folks. I heard a lot of crackling in the background, so I don't know what was with that. Hello?
Yeah, we got you.
That's yeah, okay. Yeah, I heard a lot of, yes, someone must have had a speaker on, and I was hearing some disturbing or disruption in the background.
That's just the black helicopters listening.
Yeah, we heard it good, okay. It was a little crackling. It didn't disrupt what the message was.
Okay, great. Yeah, because what I did not do is I didn't close any of the mics when I played it. Perhaps I should have made a little disclaimer beforehand to mute the mics, or perhaps I would. I refrain from muting mics unless I absolutely have to, which, of course, some well know that I've had to do that. So if anyone on, whether Chris, I'd like to start with Chris or Rex or Kelly, if any of them would like to chime in on that and kind of connect it with our state sovereignty and authority, that would be great. So whoever likes to start with that.
Yeah. Well, you said my name, so I'll shoot and then I'll get out of your way. I think we all knew this back in Egypt when this all started. And I think we were told this was the direction that we have to go and that we were full of crap, that the Muslim Brotherhood were wonderful people that did great things in their communities to help poor people. And I believe that, it was a Republican, John McCain, that really pushed this. So I believe that none of these guys know what they're doing, or they have an alternative motive that none of us know about, or we can only guess or speculate or which conspiracy theory you want to take. But we're not doing it right, and they are no longer accountable to us. How many conflicts has America been in since the Great Wars where we really had to do something? And why did they do them? I think what's happening is 50, 60 years later, we're standing up going, they're not representing us. I didn't tell them they could go over there. You know what I'm saying? I think this is what ties into what the whole state's authority, rights, sovereignty is. It's out of control. We have spent 50, 60, 70, 80 years, giving government the power to make all the decisions for us, and nobody, like Rex says, nobody, we've given up our sovereignty. We've given up our citizenship. We just kind of work and do our own thing and look up once in a while every 4 years and complain and vote and then piss and moan about taxes and the next war and the next war and the next war and the next war. And that, I think that's why this discussion that we're having is really good, because we need to find out where we came from, because I don't think we know anymore. It's such a convoluted mess right now, you know, and people are scared and confused. And you shouldn't be scared and confused. You should have answers. So anyway, that's my input.
Well, would Chris or not Chris, you just did, I keep saying that, would Kelly or Rex like to chime in?
Sure. Why not? I think that if you really take a step back, and sometimes, look, right now we're kind of in a tactical battle, and obviously tomorrow night's show will be very tactical because we're talking about the next 54 days. But when you're looking strategically, you kind of got to take the 30,000-foot view and kind of look back and see the patterns and see the connections and the relationships. And if you look at it, the simple fact is, again, the government is not the problem, because our government is the U.S. Constitution. It's not the legislative branch. It's not the executive branch. It's not the Supreme Court. The U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and it still works. Granted, it needs to be amended a little bit because the 16th and 17th Amendments are problematic, and some of the wording in the 14th is actually bad as well, but for the most part, it works. What happens is you allow men who seek power to take the position and then stretch them. But the only way they can stretch the authority of those positions and diminish states' authority is if they have financing. So the root of the problem is an unending stream of money, which goes back to the abdication of congressional authority and the abdication of constitutional constraints on government, which dates back to November 22nd, 1910, and came full on December 23rd, 1913. We're going to hit 100 years next year. And that was the creation of the Federal Reserve scheme that pumps this money that is owned by transnational interests who seek conflict and war in order to finance all sides of the conflict and consolidate their power and money. They send our military overseas to break shit up, and then they charge us to rebuild it. In the meantime, they're reaping massive profit. And this is where the core problem is. It is an issue of an abdication of power by giving over the power of the purse to a foreign entity, which is the Federal Reserve scheme. So that's what has to be unraveled, and then people have to understand what the Constitution is, and then you have to realize that all those people that we're fighting with overseas, they are not actually our enemy. Some of them are. I mean, I think that, you know, Muslim jihadists, frankly, you know, I pray for them because Christ commands me to pray for my enemies, but really the only way you deal with those guys is you have to kill them because they don't understand anything better. They choose to be martyrs? Fantastic. We'll make them martyrs faster. But the fact is that it is our corruption, our perversion, the parasite that has taken hold of our host that is the problem. It is in our country, it is in our people, it is in our Constitution or our Bill of Rights. It's just those that we've allowed to take power, and they do it through invisible mechanisms of your acquiescence. So what you need to do is just wake up, take the red pill, okay, and start acting like an American. The whole thing will come crashing down.
Excellent.
Hey, Kelly?
Yeah, right here.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, endless supply of money. Yeah, endless supply of money, printing money for wars, fueling the military-industrial complex. Oh, that's right. I sound like JFK now. He issued Executive Order 11110, printing United States notes backed by gold and silver, and he also wanted to get the troops out of Vietnam. A few months later, he was dead. It was the exact same approach that Ron Paul was proposing. And there's something about currency and causing inflation that robs people of their savings. It's time for a joke now. So if you work for the Federal Reserve, you print money out of thin air, and you talk about QE3, you might be a Bilderberger. So here's the solution again, back to the Constitution. It's very clear that only the federal government can print coin money, which the intent there was gold and silver. I'll just read it here. This is Article 2, Section 10, powers prohibited to the states. No state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of marque and reprisal, coin money. States can't coin money. Emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. Now, if the states can step up and say, all right, that's it. Right here, this is our right, we're going to do it. It says clearly make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. That would get us, the states would individually say, we ain't accepting Federal Reserve notes because the Constitution prohibits us from accepting paper money. The Constitution says we only take gold and silver coins. And pretty soon our war machine would be pretty much shut down. I mean, I'm very theoretical here, but we've went way, way far from this.
Well, I watched the video, and it blew my mind, and I'll try to find it again. It was one of those presidents around, I don't remember who it was, Truman. I don't know. I can't remember. I have to find it. I have it in my file of a million items. But he was on television, black and white TV, explaining about this new part of our economy and a permanent part of the future of America, the industrial war complex.
It was Dwight D. Eisenhower, and he said on his last night of office, we must guard against the military-industrial complex. For every bomber, B-52, we could instead make a school, and he went into civil projects instead of the military, and he warned us about it.
Now, I'm going to have to get that video.
Why We Fight.
So
Why We Fight is where he talks about it, and they have an investigator who explains how we have all these military bases all over the country, and it's very expensive. And you can guess why Ron Paul was suppressed, because he thought, like JFK, let's go back to gold and silver currency or something that has intrinsic value, and let's stop all these wars. JFK was dead a few months later after he did the same thing.
Interesting. Rex?
Rex? I think they're calling on the Rex.
Oh, yeah. I'm here. I'm sorry. What was the question? I was done with my monologue. I'm assuming I'm answering a question.
Well, we were kind of talking about the industrial war machine. We kind of spun off there a little bit.
Yeah, okay. So there wasn't a question. You just wanted me to chime in on it. Fair enough. Look, the idea of you know, quote, the military-industrial complex, I mean, that's nothing more than an efficient means for some to make profit. Look, the fact is that you need industry and you need a military, but those are always supposed to be subservient to the constraints of the Constitution, and that will always be the case. And as was pointed out, if the currency is gold and silver and it cannot be inflated, then it is incumbent when you go to war to prosecute it quickly, efficiently, and then return home, because there isn't enough treasure to continue it. The fact that there's an unlimited supply of money makes it very attractive to perpetuate the war, and that, of course, doesn't only cost a lot as far as debasement of the monetary supply and also the increase of debt, which turns us all into debt slaves, but it also costs us a lot in blood. And the fact is that we have the military might right now and the superiority to our enemies that we can actually prosecute our military conflicts rather rapidly with minimal loss of life, get in, get the job done, and get out. But, see, that would entail actually going to war for a just reason. When you go to war under pretext in order to conquer and destroy and then rebuild and charge the taxpayers for the difference, then it takes on a whole different paradigm. I mean, for example, we go back to the Iraq War. That war was over in 3 weeks. We had won. Okay? There's no need for us to be there for 8 or 9 or 10 years. And the reason that was done simply is because it's profitable. So the very simple fact is, if you're going to go topple somebody like Saddam, which one could argue whether that should or shouldn't have been done, but I would say based on the information available at the time, there was concern over WMD. And before anybody gets into that argument with me, we knew that he had weapons of mass destruction, especially Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, because those are the assholes that sold it to him in the first place. So, of course, they knew he had them because we're the ones that sold them to him to use against Iran. So the very simple fact is you go in there, you topple the guy, but you don't leave a vacuum and you don't occupy the place. You set up a parliamentary monarchy and you keep the tribes at bay and you give them some kind of representation, but you keep a strong man in place to keep them all from killing each other, and you bring your troops back home. It's very simple. We could have been in and out in 60 days.
Hey, Rex, I am terribly confused. Am I talking to conservatives here or liberals?
Well, if you're asking me, I eschew labels drastically because I think that the false left-right paradigm, and in fact, even the use of the word liberal conservative is disgusting. It's a mind trick, okay? You're talking to a patriots, okay? I think constitutionalists. And I think that the conversation, I mean, we all started out as basically Gingrich conservatives in this current campaign, but the fact is that in truth, when you really dig down and try to find out who you are, everybody, whether you're on the so-called left or the right, you'll realize that if you're really serious, you're a constitutionalist and you transcend the false left-right paradigm.
Brilliant.
You know what I heard today?
So I'm a conservative liberal.
Go ahead, Kelly.
I seek to conserve the liberal documents our founders gave us.
Yeah, I want to go into war a little bit. This is opening a can of worms.
I like war.
Well, maybe we can play this.
That's what makes us neocons, right? No, I'm just kidding.
As long as we execute it, kick their butt, and come home and tell them not to do it again, or we'll come back and kick their ass again. It's that simple to me. This game is what makes us neocons. War is, peace, people who want ultimate peace, wrong earth, sorry. But we're going to have conflicts. We're America, like Robert says. We're a world leader. We're an influencer. We took on the role after the Second World War, and we got ourselves out there trying to do good. Well, now we're in a mess. And the bottom line is, somebody attacks us or somebody threatens one of our solid, true, democratic friends, you know what I'm saying, and you go help them and you kick butt and you go home. That's simple.
Yeah.
It should never be any more complex than that. Anybody ever deal with a bully in school? You didn't go home and clean his house and make his garden for him after you kicked his butt.
I'm sure everyone's heard this quote. What does the military do? They break things and kill people. That's their job. They have two jobs, to break things and kill people. That's it.
Ask my son. He can tell you what they do.
They're supposed to break things and kill people. That's what the military is for.
And
if you use it for that purpose, you'll be fine.
Yeah. Oh, he hated the second tour over there. He said they were, you talked about they wouldn't let the, earlier when you started the show, you were talking about they had no ammunition in their weapons. What kind of crap is that? Well, his second tour, or even towards the end of his first tour, they were afraid to fire on the enemy because there were so many penalties and so much crappy paperwork you had to fill out. A guy shot at me, so I killed him, and then you spend 5 hours filling out paperwork. Then you got to go to a hearing because you pulled the trigger on a bad guy. I'm telling you, man, they're destroying the machine that the military is made for. They're trying to make us the peacekeepers of the world. No wonder these guys are going nuts when they get home. They can't take their enemy out. God. Sorry.
Yeah.
I ranted.
I'm going to go into discussion about...
Go ahead, Kelly. That's all I was saying.
Okay, I want to have a discussion about war, open up a can of worms. Not that I want to go to war per se, and Chris, if you want to play war online, we can play Risk. That's always fun. Oh, by the way, do you know why Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait? So he could get a Risk card.
What?
Anyway, if you're playing the game Risk, you attack, you want Risk cards, you have to conquer a country to kill
the game. I remember the game Risk, yeah.
Yeah, so that's why Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, to get a Risk card. All right, anyway, how many unplayed wars have we had since World War II?
All of them? Wait.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so we've had the Korean conflict. What do they call it, the war? No, we did declare war. World War One, World War Two, the Korean conflict, we had Vietnam, we had Kosovo, we had Iraq One, we had Iraq Two, and then we had Afghanistan, and now it's unofficial, but it's Yemen. We have hit
Grenada, all that crap in South America.
Yeah, okay. So what's happened is, well, we just go back to the Constitution again. Powers granted to Congress. Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 11. The power
haven't
of Congress
used that
to declare war.
1942.
Right. Declare war. Right, letters of marking are reprisal and make rules concerning captures on land and water. This is regarding war. So the Congress has this power. Oh, but wait a minute. They kind of delegated it to the War Powers Act, if I can't remember what year that was. The War Powers Act does authorize the president to go to war for 60 days. And, of course, that makes sense because if we're invaded, the president can't say, hey, Congress, yes or no, what do you think? You know, we're about to lose Alabama. You know, Forrest Gump's a good soldier there, but we got to protect him. Now, there's arguments over the president has the power to protect our borders, obviously the intent, and, of course, you know, some of our allies. But when these things go on beyond 60 days, where is Congress? And the power of the states to enforce the Constitution by saying, look, if it was under apportionment, look, until you have a declaration of war from Congress, we ain't paying for it. We're keeping that 15% of our budget you're going to spend on this war. Sorry, but we don't have that kind of system anymore.
Well, that's precisely why.
And we have John Boehner, and he cries and cuts more money to Obama. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that's precisely why the Income Tax Act was passed along with the Federal Reserve Act, because when the money comes to Washington and then goes back to the states, they lose their authority. In truth, if you're going to have a tax system, and I think that an income tax is actually unconstitutional, but the tax system is valid, the state should collect the revenue from its citizens and then forward its apportioned amount to the federal government. If you do that, then the states would retain their authority. It's the power of the purse. And in reversing that, we ended up with the situation we ended up with, which is that, you know, the last officially declared war was in Bulgaria in 1942, and since then we've essentially been engaged in the Orwellian construct of perpetual war for perpetual peace. And that's there hasn't been a period of time post-World War II where we have not been engaged in a foreign military conflict or occupation of some form or another. And that is just preposterous when you think about it as what you think America is versus what we have been for the last 70 years. They don't line up. And it's a difficult thing to accept because we tend to be fearful of pointing fingers at ourselves or seeming unpatriotic. But I think the distinction is that in the cultural Marxism that we're embedded in, we confuse the term patriotism with the word nationalism. And for the most part, people who think they're patriotic are actually nationalistic. If you're a true patriot in the American sense of the word, you will always be critical of your government and you will always be vigilant against its encroachment. And we have not been, and that's why we are where we are.
Have you heard the word patriot defined? Somebody shared this with me. I thought it was real good. Well, we the people are the parents of the government. We are the parents.
Mm-hmm.
Paternal in patriot. Paternal means obviously mom and dad. Riot. Paternal riot. Yeah. unruling disobedient child is out of control, so we ought to be patriots in a paternal riot.
That's a humorous and very Anglo-Saxon view of the word patriot. It actually comes from the Latin patria, which means of the father, and it basically means that if you're a patriot, you are of the fatherland, meaning that the country, which is not only the soil but also the blood of the people that live there, that's what you're truly a patriot of. So the fact is that if you're a real patriot, you love your country. It's your government you distrust.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it should be. See, people these days think if you distrust the government, you're not a patriot. Well, you know, that's never been the case in America historically. We've always distrusted our government. The entire reason that the Constitution was drafted was because we distrusted the very men. In fact, the men distrusted themselves who drafted the document, which is why they drafted it. So loving your country and distrusting your government are not incompatible. In fact, it's necessary. And unfortunately, we've shifted that 180 degrees where we are now pledging our allegiance to the government and distrusting our fellow patriots because they're subversive terrorists who wear tinfoil hats.
Yeah, and by the way, speaking of word definitions...
I like my tinfoil hat. Oh,
speaking of word definitions, again, this DHS document... Oh, by the way, that came out 3 years ago, March of 2009. It recently got unclassified. But under the definition, we've used the word patriot, we've used the word militia, we've used the word sovereign citizen, and it's in their definitions on this non-normal media broadcast, so, you know, I don't know. Maybe I got to get me a tinfoil hat.
Hey, Rex, we were talking about making money earlier today.
Yeah, I think I'm going to start manufacturing tinfoil hats, and we'll be selling them for $3.95. Just hit me up on Facebook, and I'll get you yours right away. Free shipping this month only.
Hey, we can high-tech them. We can high-tech them and pipe the radio shows into them.
Yeah, it comes preloaded with Bard's Logic Political Talk and the Tex and Rex Show and Sammy Sanford.
Oh, my God. When's this show, when is your show over, Rob?
About 15 minutes ago.
Was it?
No.
Oh.
We've just digressed.
Well, yeah,
well,
I think
I missed it. I knew I shouldn't have been typing. No.
No. I just finally
get us back on track.
I just finally cleaned up all my chat.
Just get us back on track, Kelly. Get us back on track.
Well, I could set it out. You know, we talked about the decades. Oh, I forgot to mention 1765, which was where the Declaration of Rights, there was two Declaration of Rights. There was 1765, so the movement was growing, and then the Declaration of Rights of 1774, we gave the king two chances, and that's it. 1776, we're done with you. But I want to go ahead and read a little bit more specifics as examples from different states of their histories, if you will, and... I'm going to grab some documents here. And Virginia is a real good one. As you know, I think it was June 30th, 1776. They had their own state constitution as a colonial legislature approved. And then July 4th, 1776, they became their own state. And then in 1778, they approved the Articles of Confederation. I'm giving a specific date here. Virginia was in December 15th, 1778. They approved the Constitution. They were a little bit hesitant on the Constitution. It needed nine states. They weren't one of the first nine to make it ratified. But they did it on June 25th, 1788. And then in the Bill of Rights, they approved the Bill of Rights in 1791. So that's one state, you know, taking them from pre-declaration all the way to approving the Bill of Rights. Let me give you another state here. South Carolina, it was March 1776, the colonial legislature approved a state constitution. July 4th, they did their declaration with all 13 states in unity. And then the Articles of Confederation, South Carolina approved that on February 5th, 1778. They joined the Union in 1778, a little while after the Articles of Confederation were ratified. Then we go to the Constitution. They approved the Constitution. It was 10 years later, South Carolina, May 23rd, 1788. And then they approved the Bill of Rights in 1790. You can see how each of these states, and I didn't have time, but I want to put the real detailed dates of each state, and you can read state by state as they went through a cultural change, and they realized, oh, my gosh, we can do this, and here's our plan, and here's our state constitution, and here's our union, and da-da-da-da-da. But it took literally from the 1760s, as people like Samuel Adams, I like the beer, but he was going around the 1760s to bars and taverns, and he was telling people, "Yeah, Georgia's bad." Yeah, and so the cultural change happened. Of course, you know, you had Thomas Paine, you had Patrick Henry, others orating. John Adams was orating in the early 1770s. He had Thomas Jefferson, they're all saying these things, you know. Thomas Jefferson said this, "But no more be said about the confidence in men, but rather bind him down by the chains of the Constitution." And so they all had this thinking. And then there was one little problem is they got the Constitution ratified, and then it was, "Oh, whoops, sorry about that, here's the Bill of Rights, guys." But notice how quickly they got on it. They got on it, and would our government do this now? There is actually a movement. It's an Article 5 movement. It's called Article 5 in the Constitution. Yeah. How to actually amend the Constitution. There is an organization that has sued the federal government to require an Article 5 convention so we can have amendments. That is, we have a balanced budget amendment with enough states telling the federal government, look, we want it. We've got enough states. This is back in the 60s. The federal government ignored it. Where are we headed?
Where are we heading? I guess that's the question. You got Obama and his vision for America that we know, and Romney and his vision for America we don't know. But I believe that neither one of them have anything to do with what we believe this country should be.
That's,
well, I didn't know it was that heavy. Yeah. Everybody got real quiet.
Well, that's
we were
why I'm
concentrating on your words, Chris.
Yeah.
We're concentrating the words.
Contemplating. Well, that's why I'm headed for Gary Johnson, okay? I don't like some of his social positions. I wish he was more states' rights, like the Libertarian Party has been historically. But you know what? If he cuts the federal government by 43%, the DHS ain't going to have much power. The DHS is going to be like, we don't have the money, we don't have staff. Oh, that's right. Gary Johnson is going to get rid of the DHS, the NDAA, Patriot Act, the Federal Reserve. He is, I believe, you know, if the social issues are states' rights issues, he is absolutely the closest to our founding document of all three candidates. That's my personal belief.
Well, let me ask you this, because I'm still vetting. So let me ask you this: have you spent time studying Good's positions on this stuff?
Chris, I want to interject here real quick. Let me interject this real quick. We don't use any like French accents here on the show, Chris. So if you can refrain from going "good" and just say "good," I like the sound of that better. I'm just joking with you, man.
Hey, the only reason I do that is
I just made a comment
French.
About the "good" comment because I'm like, no, don't say it's French because that might turn some people away if they think that.
No, you know
French.
What? It's not French. It's English. But I heard his name pronounced. On a interview today, so I'm trying to do it right.
Yeah, well, you mentioned something about French earlier in a conversation. I'm like, no French. No, I'm just joking. I'm just throwing a little.
I didn't know if it was I didn't know if it was good or goody. I honestly, I'm ignorant, and I don't mean that any disrespect by that. So sorry.
Hey, it depends on where you come from, but down here we pronounce it good. Y'all
good.
May not be able to understand the slow pace of a true Southern Virginian accent, but if you listen for a while, it'll actually be some of the sweetest sound you've ever heard the English language spoken in.
It probably
but I don't employ
lot,
that often because
probably
I
sounds
speak
a lot better
fast.
Coming from a woman, though, right? Right?
Yeah, unfortunately, Virgil Good is a man, so you'll have to learn to deal with it with him.
Yeah, I guess.
So anyway, Kelly, not to get you off the hot seat, but have you studied his platform on this stuff? And you know me, I'm not being facetious. I'm just asking a real question.
No, I straight up with you, I haven't studied Good's platform very much. The I'm more of a practical in the sense that if I can make a difference with Gary Johnson, if he can double what Ross Perot did, he will be our next president.
Yeah,
and I know.
And I get that.
Well, the other thing with libertarians, I just want to throw this out. I kind of mentioned it briefly, but look, if we can actually start libertarian parties, or even be in our counties, we can become delegates to the national convention, not to take over the libertarians at all. They're our allies. Simply clarify, the social issues are states' rights. Now let's call our federal government in check. And that is something we can do. I was there at the convention. I'm like, oh, my gosh. I even put up a plank that they suspended the rules to vote on. And I was like, oh, my gosh, it's not that hard. It's not like the Republicans were, forget it. They're gonna, you know, if that would have happened, by the way, the Republican boondoggle at Tampa, if that would top libertarian people were telling us, if the Libertarian Party would have done that, heads would be rolling. So So it's still a fresh, it's still a party that we can actually participate in. They are allies in the Constitution. They're nuts about it. And it's something we can actually do.
Well, well with that, folks, I know it's only got 5 minutes left, and there's a couple things I'd like to do. One is I want to make the statement, and that's why the reasons why we're going to have some of the good people on here, or goody or good or whatever way people would like to pronounce that, is that I just say good because I like the sound of good people. But, no, that's what we're going to have, folks, and I actually, for the people who don't already know, that I've been in contact with the people from the Gary Johnson campaign, and we're hoping early October to have Gary Johnson himself on, and then, of course, before then, perhaps some of the people from his campaign or people from the Libertarian Party, as well as, you know, from the Further Good, and we can check them both out and see what we, you know, decide from there. And also, I'd like to let everyone know to continue this discussion, at least with Tex and Rex. And Tex, what I'd like to do is Tex, if you, I mean, not Tex, but Rex, if you could tell them about your show tomorrow, tomorrow evening. I know yours is at 8, and then this one starts at 9 o'clock tomorrow. And then we'll go with Chris, and then Kelly, if you'd like to close out, but if everyone just take about a minute and close things out that way. And, thank you very much. I want to thank the panel. Yeah, for coming on tonight, Rex Christie and Chris and Kelly Mordecai, thank you very much for all of you've done for the show tonight and previous, of course. Thank you for the audience for coming in and listening, and also you on the archives who've listened to it through. So go ahead, Rex, if you tell us about your show tomorrow night on the Tex and Rex show, that'd be great.
Okay, well, Tex and Rex kind of had a severely irregular and heavy schedule since the tempest in Tampa. And we were both taking our journeys back to various spots last week, so there was no Friday and Saturday show. But starting tomorrow night, we will be regularly on from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. You can find us on Blog Talk Radio. Just search Tex and Rex Show. We will be talking. We were talking about a broker convention up through the broker convention. And now we are talking about liberty, and that's what the show will be about. Obviously, tomorrow night we have a slight overlap, so if you feel like getting warmed up, join Tex and Rex from 8 to 9, and then hop on over to Bard's Logic Political Talk, and we might even pipe in the Tex and Rex show into Robert's show tomorrow. We'll see how that works out. But Tex and Rex is unscripted, and we are irreverent, relevant, and radioactive conservatism with a bite. There are very few rules on the show, so feel free to call in and join us tomorrow night and also on Saturday. And we'll also be on Sammy's and Robert's as well.
Thank you very much, Rex. And go ahead, Chris.
Well,
any
what
last,
I
want to talk about in a minute?
No, what I want to do is, you know, is promote tomorrow because it's taken a while to get some of the good folks on. Sorry, I had to do that. But so, you know, please join us. You know, and I apologize for overlapping these shows and cutting into Tex and Rex. That was my fault. I did that. I was pushing hard to get these guys on and get this going before I looked at the bigger picture. What we need to talk about is when are we going to get together on this topic right now? Kelly, sounds like somebody's doing their nails.
Oh, no, I'm just laughing. It's something that just happened. This will be my last minute here. I'm at a friend's place. His name's Limey. He's barely been here for about 20, 30 years. And circumstances brought me here and doing this here. He goes, "Hey, Waco, did you get off the phone? I don't want to be put on some list. Go to the parking lot." And I'm like, oh goodness, he's a little bit, he's more awake than most Americans. He's afraid of something. He knows what I'm up to. But another funny, last funny is on the 4th of July 1 year, I got him to light fireworks. It took an 18 pack to get this Brit to light the fireworks. But he himself is, he's a little worried that I'm, you know, he's going to be on a list now.
So, and well, we're talking about, you know, the next time you want to do one of these state sovereignty shows. And that's something we could schedule at another time.
Well, I think the gentleman Chris talked to today, we got to get him because he's light years ahead of us. I'm still learning, but I'm realizing, oh, my gosh, this is upside down.
Yeah, he's tagging us. He's tagging us as we're talking.
What's that? What's
you
that?
Know,
so
he's like that.
I've got less than a minute, and, yes, everyone, of course, start off the night with Tex and Rex show. As I said, it's 8 p.m. Eastern time. And then also look for another one of these state authority and sovereignty shows. And everyone take care. Looking forward to talking to you again. And this will be recorded, but I'd like to end the show with the song by Aubrey Ashburn. It kind of brings us down. So if the folks on the line who will not be hung up on, please enjoy the music. And everyone in the chat, good night. Thank you.